governor's office came right at the wrong time. So we
okay, I'm going to call to order this hearing of the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. We are on February 13th, 2017, and I want to congratulate the members and the audience members for making it through the fire line to get in here for this hearing.
You need an EMT. We know where they are.
That's right.
So we have no committee bills, right?
Okay. That's mine.
We have public hearings on four bills today, and we're going to take them in order. So I'm going to open a public hearing first on Senate Bill 100. Mike, you want to come up? And while he's doing that, Beth, you want to tell us what Senate Bill 100 does?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 100 would update statutes that govern the state home oil weatherization program. There's no subsequent referral for this bill.
Okay, Mike, can you tell us about this program and why it needs to be changed?
Sure. Good afternoon, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, Michael Kaplan, Director of the Oregon Department of Energy, here to testify in support of Senate Bill 100, which relates to the State Home Oil Weatherization Program, or SHO. It's a relatively simple bill. It's a little bit more than house cleaning. I think it's more like spring cleaning. The bill will align our policies and procedures with statute and create greater efficiencies for the program within the agency. The bill removes several outdated references to components of the program that no longer operate. It removes and clarifies several definitions. It assures rulemaking authority for the agency so that we can better administer the program over time, allows us to provide better customer service, which I'll explain in just a few minutes, and creates some clear authority that we think we need for the administrative funds and program funds for the program. As background, the Oregon Department of Energy has administered SHO and the Petroleum Supplier Assessment that acts as its funding mechanism. The SHO program was created in 1981 as part of Oregon's Residential Energy Conservation Act. Homeowners who use fuel oil dealers to provide the primary source of their home heating are eligible for the SHO program. The SHO program provides a maximum benefit of $500 per homeowner or to their contractor to install space heating improvements or energy efficiency measures in their home. In addition, the SHO program also works directly with 17 community action agencies who identify low-income homeowners who are eligible for Oregon Housing and Community Services low-income weatherization program and provides up to $2,500 to the CAP on behalf of the homeowner to install energy efficiency projects in their homes. For the last 33 years, SHO has served more than 12,000 homes in Oregon, including approximately $6.9 million to eligible homeowners or community action agencies. To give you a little bit more recent flavor, in 2015 and 2016, 516 homeowners completed 651 measures, including 178 window replacements, 112 attic insulation installations, which is a tongue twister I'm very proud to have just delivered, 58 floor insulation installations, and 157 programmable thermostats. Currently, by statute, Oregon Department of Energy is required to contract with another state agency to provide customer assistance and technical advice. That agency is currently the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Under the contract, DCBS provides services to potential SHO applicants by maintaining a call center, maintaining a link to our website, distributing information packets that we assemble, and attending periodic trainings that we administer. Callers are often referred back to ODO after they call DCBS, and the amount of calls that DCBS has dwindled to about 150 a year, sometimes as little as one per month. We are invoiced monthly for that service. I think it would be in both agencies' interest for us to be able to provide that work directly. It would be a very small, much smaller cost for us and likely get rid of a very small responsibility for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The funding for the program and for the administration comes from an assessment to 9 petroleum suppliers in Oregon. The amount of the assessment is set by the director of the Department of Energy and is capped at $400,000 per year. The bill repeals something called a fuel oil dealer program, which hasn't functioned for several years. It removes definitions for commercial lending institution and cost effective from an area of statute that does not use either of those references. It clarifies that funds received through the petroleum supplier assessment may be used for the administration of SHO and the program itself. It provides a more refined definition for contractor that would clearly indicate that community action agencies are eligible for the resources, and it allows the Department of Energy to provide its own customer service for the program that we've been administering in place of DCBS. It's a long-winded way of saying that the bill eliminates some obsolete statutes, some program practices, and creates better efficiency within the department and clarifies rules that govern the administration of SHO and the petroleum supplier assessment. That's it. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Before we get into questions about the bill, I have a question about the program. So is it a program that is distributed all over the state, or is it mainly rural? Is it mainly urban? Is it a mix?
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, it's distributed throughout the state. However, I think you see greater concentrations in places where fuel oil dealers are operating. So outside of our urban areas, you'll see a greater confluence of the services being provided.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you very much. It says in the bill that cash payments to a dwelling owner or a contractor for energy conservation measures. If a homeowner goes in and wants to put in a new heating unit, that has to be something that is done by a licensed contractor. Do you allow payments to the homeowner if he tries to do it himself?
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, Senator Olson, it depends on the project. Yes, the homeowner can do some work themselves. Oftentimes, the cash payment is to a contractor who does the work on behalf of the homeowner, though.
Follow-up. So I guess the point I'm trying to get to is if it is required to be done by a licensed contractor, then they would handle that part. But if you want to change a window or do insulation that a homeowner can do, you're okay with that. But I also read in here that it doesn't cover their labor. Is that correct?
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, Senator Olson, that's exactly right.
Thank you.
Any other questions? No? Okay. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you very much.
All right, great. I'm going to close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 100. Colleagues, let me know if you have any issues with this, and otherwise I'll schedule it for a work session. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 222. And let's have Ron Murray and Rebecca Rodriguez come up first, please. And actually, Sherry Morris-Dunn. Sherry, why don't you come up as well? Get you all up here at the same time. And while they're getting settled, Beth, can you tell us what this bill is about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 222 would direct the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examining Board to adopt rules to require veterinarians who prescribe medicine to provide the animal owner with a copy of the prescription and a written statement that the owner may purchase a prescription from the prescriber or a pharmacy chosen by the owner. There's no subsequent referral on the bill.
Okay, thank you. Ron, do you want to kick us off?
Thank you, Senator. Chairman Dembrough, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Ron Murray, and I represent Oregon Dog Pack. And Senate Bill 222 is very simply a consumer bill, and it's being presented not only as an animal care bill, but as a consumer advocacy bill. I think as we listen to the press and watch TV and read the newspaper, we know that human beings in America, there's an influx of information regarding medicines and prescription and drug costs. We don't see that in animal care products. And we know that the competition for human products is what's driving the price of human medicine down. Senate Bill 222 will spur competition by reducing veterinary medicine costs by up to two-thirds. The current law in the state of Oregon, yes, it does allow a veterinarian to give a written prescription to the owner of an animal. This obviously is not a fact that's advertised. And the reason for that is because veterinary costs, veterinary medicine costs, are so much more exorbitant than if that prescription was taken to Fred Meyer or Costco or Walmart. I can speak from experience. We have a diabetic dog, and the cost of insulin, which we happen to buy at Costco, is one-third of what our corporate veterinary charges. And I go through 6 vials a year at $150 a vial. I think a good bill would be how I can put my poodle on Medicare, but that's another point. You will be receiving an email tomorrow, and I apologize in advance for all the emails you've been receiving. The folks that support the bill, they're not experts at the process. And his veterinarian is marking up the medicine 800% because there's no competition, and he finally found it at Walmart. Reducing the costs of veterinary care and the medicines that are prescribed to dogs, cats, and companion animals is going to have a wide effect on animal care. Many people can't afford to take their dogs to the veterinarian, dogs or cats. That's a simple fact. So this bill impacts retired pet owners, low-income pet owners, young families, and Oregonians who have lost their job because they can no longer afford to take their animals to the vet. And let's be honest, typically you're going to take your animal to the vet and you're going to walk away with some medicine. And how is that medicine typically dispensed? The veterinarian's going to say, when you pay your bill, pick it up at the counter. It's never offered. A written prescription is never offered unless it's demanded. And I think this is best put into perspective by an executive director of one of Oregon's largest humane societies who said, well, I have a prescription and I just take it to my local Fred Meyer. And I said, well, of course you do. Your office is concurrent with the Oregon State School of Veterinary Medicine. You know the ropes. The average citizen doesn't know that this is a service that's available. You're going to hear, yes, there are negatives to Senate Bill 222. One is the average pharmacy at the grocery store is not going to have sufficient inventory. Why would they? Currently, the demand is not there for them to carry the medicine, so there's no need for them to carry the inventory. When Senate Bill 222 passes, that will change. We've heard that pharmacists don't have the experience to give out prescriptions for animals. That simply isn't true. And I'm sure that the Oregon State Board of Pharmacy would tell you that our pharmacists are licensed and they do have the experience to give out medicine for your dog and cat. If they can't give me medicine for my dog and cat, I'm going to really wonder about my heart medicine and my prostate medicine and everything else that I go to them for every single month. I think they can handle cat and flea medicine. I think that there is no legitimate argument against Senate Bill 222. I understand the industry wants to protect themselves. They want to protect their income. And there's a huge markup in the medicine that is dispensed at a veterinary clinic. We are asking that you give Oregonians simply a choice. That this bill is very simple. All it says is, the customer gets a written prescription. It can be filled at the veterinarian or it can be taken someplace else for a competitive price. And if it's more convenient to fill it at the veterinarian, have it filled at the veterinarian. But give the people the opportunity to make the choice on their own. And with that, we are asking for a work session on Senate Bill 222. And if I can answer any questions, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ron. And Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you.
I look forward to hearing about the WTF PAC.
Whatever the face PAC, that's what I'm here representing. It's a new political action committee that is dedicated to the animal world. And thank you all so much for allowing me to testify here on behalf of SB 222. My name, again, is Rebecca Rodriguez, and I'm a lifelong animal advocate. I have been working for animals for decades, anything from fostering to adoptions to program development to mediation. And I'm here to testify in favor of the bill. Over the past several years, the standards for companion animals has changed dramatically. Not only are people incorporating animals into their lives in a much more personal and heartfelt way, but as a community, collectively, we are always striving to elevate the standards for animals. And the love that people have for animals fuels a multi-billion dollar industry in this country. And you know, 20 years ago, animals didn't have complete wardrobes of outfits for football games and hats for different times of the year. There weren't a gazillion different types of foods available, and there weren't accessories of every shape and size. There were, and people, most people years ago didn't feel like a bad pet parent if they didn't take their animal in for a dental. Now, the pet products industry, the nonprofit sector, and the vet community, they work diligently to inspire people to include an animal in their lives. They're promoting the beauty of companionship, unconditional love, and they are pushing to elevate the standards for animals so they can live a happy and healthy life. Now, the reason that I feel that SB 222 is so important is that these market segments, the nonprofit sector, the vet community, and the pet products industry, have done a tremendous job promoting the benefits and joys that animals bring to our lives. And more people than ever are incorporating animals into their lives, and many of those people are low income or on fixed incomes. Now, while I believe that there are veterinarians who already practice what is laid out in this bill, I believe that many don't. And it's been my experience that pet parents don't realize that this is an option for them, that they can take a pet, that they can request a written prescription and take that prescription to have it filled at a less expensive venue. Now, there are people who privately and some openly that believe that individuals who can't necessarily afford to provide a certain level of care for their animals, that those people should not be able to have those animals. And I would argue that with millions of animals still dying in shelters in this country, and the popularity of transport and transferring animals from the higher kill areas up to areas like here in the Pacific Northwest, that we're not, ethically, we're not, we don't have the luxury to deny people a companion animal based on their income bracket. So people love animals, and there are certainly countless animals that need homes. And finding a way to help people with fewer resources to become better pet parents should be the goal of every community and of every market segment that benefits financially from companion animals. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Rebecca. Ms. Doan? No? Oh, DV. Sorry, Ms. Morris. Dr. Morris.
Hi, Sherry Morris. I'm the past president of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. I am a practice owner here in Oregon. The Oregon Veterinary Medical Association has long supported consumer choice with regard to obtaining veterinary prescriptions. Veterinarians across the state have honored clients' requests to have prescriptions filled outside the practice. To illustrate this, a few years ago, we conducted a survey on pharmacy-related issues, and this is what we learned. 97% of practices in Oregon have been meeting the client's wishes on prescriptions. What you might not know is that oftentimes we match the cost of a drug that our clients find from a standalone pharmacy or from a drug outlet on the internet. If we're unable to match the price, then we'll work with our clients to ensure that our patients get the medications that they need at a lesser cost. Of the remaining 3% of the clinics, another 2% have honored the request but also reserved the right to not issue a prescription to an outside pharmacy that has previously filled a prescription without the appropriate authorization by attending veterinarians. This has happened more often than you think. And then, two, a significant majority of veterinary practices in our survey, 94% of them, had been presenting clients with prescriptions to have them filled at a pharmacy of their choosing without adding a prescription fee. To place this in different perspective, there are roughly 500 veterinary clinics in Oregon. According to our survey result, only 30 charged a handling fee for writing prescriptions. Today, all veterinary clinics must honor a client's request with regard to veterinary prescriptions. A little more than 3 years ago, the Oregon Veterinary Medical Examining Board, our licensing agency, adopted this rule, even if a practice had a dispute with any pharmacy. The OVMEB, however, leaves it up to the individual practices to decide whether or not to assess a fee for handling a prescription. We find this to be appropriate. While the vast majority of veterinary clinics, 94%, don't charge a fee for writing the prescriptions, some businesses believe it's necessary to cover their costs in reviewing and issuing the prescriptions. They alone should determine the business policy for their practices. In my practice, we probably do 75 prescriptions a day. If that even takes us 5 minutes, that's multiple hours of our day. Now, if I may, I would like to make a general comment about prescription medications we use in veterinary medicine. The health and safety of our patients is foremost in our minds. While some of the prescriptions used in the profession are commonly available on the human side, many are not. And in addition, many prescription drugs veterinarians use are unique in the type of medications for the target species that we have, even in small animal practice and the dosage regimes. Most big box pharmacies are only interested in high volume medications like flea and tick products and heartworm preventative drugs and don't stock the majority of veterinary specific drugs that veterinarians dispense. We've also learned from experience that most pharmacists are unfamiliar with their usage in patients. We had a survey where many veterinarians had bad experiences with pharmacists, changing prescriptions, changing dosages without even consulting with the veterinarian. So monitoring the usage of these drugs is always a concern for veterinarians. Pharmacists have little or no training on animal drugs and their biochemistry in animals, and they're not always the same as in humans. I would also like to point out that it's indisputable that Oregonians love animals. That's not in dispute. At 64%, Oregon ranks fourth nationally in the number of households that have pets. There are approximately 919,000 dogs in Oregon and 1 million cats. And yet, over the years, our organization, with that number of animals, our organization's office has fielded but a handful of phone calls from consumers who have raised concerns about veterinary clinics not writing a prescription for the client to take elsewhere. And in the convening years since our licensing board has adopted the rule that requires us to honor that request with regard to prescriptions, only a half a dozen or so consumers have even complained to the Oregon Veterinary Medical Examining Board that veterinarians were charging a fee for those prescriptions. So the bottom line as we see it is that the marketplace is working. With regard to prescriptions, this benefits the consumers. Owners have more choices than ever before in our state's history as to whether or not to bring their animals for veterinary services. Owners also have more options about where to purchase their medications for their animals. Consider all of the brick and mortar pharmacies that regularly advertise now to consumers about having animal drugs, including prescription medications. This includes those chain outlets, the Costcos, the Walmarts, the Walgreens, the Rite Aids, and Fred Meyers and Safeway. They all have those things. And then you have hundreds of online pharmacies which market their products, again, including prescriptions to consumers, and with most notable being things like 1-800-PetMeds and PetMeds Express. While we recognize that some individual consumers have had poor experience with some veterinary practices regarding prescription options, we believe that this is the exception and not the rule. For this reason, we respectfully ask you to oppose the Senate Bill 222. Now, Ron talks about this as a consumer advocacy bill, but if we're talking the advocacy of pet health, I mean, the best people to make the decision on what meds and dosages, whether generics or substitutions are reasonable, is a trained professional. And most of our pharmacists have maybe one short weekend course in veterinary medicine and pharmacokinetics, and they just don't have any real knowledge about it. And number two, it's in our interest as small business people to be competitive with other outlets. If we think that people don't go online and look at the prices of prescriptions at Safeway or at Fred Meyer's or on these Pet Meds Express, then, I mean, we're crazy. We've charged them too much, then the client's going to go elsewhere. And believe me, I've been doing this for 26 years, and people regularly ask us for written prescriptions, and we give them. And people tell us when they're not happy, I'll tell you that. And so it is something that they're not willing to stay quiet about. There is an existing law here in force that veterinarians must provide a prescription form to anyone who asks. And 94% of the veterinarians don't charge for it. And if this bill aims to save pet owners money, which is what Ron is telling us, then I have two examples just from today, from being 5 minutes on the internet. I have this one, a flea and tick product out of 1-800-PetMeds. It's $89.95 for 6 doses. In my hospital, you can get 8 doses for $87, and that's 37% less. Another one here, Tramadol, a long-term pain medication for dogs. It is $62.99 for 100 count on the web, and it's $20.50 at my hospital. This is not a big problem, and in fact, we watch and we look at this on a regular basis because we have to be competitive in this competitive environment. So I respectfully oppose this bill.
Thank you very much, Dr. Morris. So I have a question first for Ron and then for you, Dr. Morris. Ron, the bill, as it's written, requires the prescriber to issue a copy of the prescription and a written statement that the owner may fill the prescription. Why the latter? Why is the latter necessary, that there has to be a written statement that the owner may fill the prescription?
I think it's here, Chair Dembrow, members of the committee. Here again, I think it's simply public awareness. What we are attempting to do with this bill is just inform the public that they can have their prescription filled either in the doctor's office or take it to where they wish. It's just informing them that this is an option available to them. In the bill, it does state that the veterinarian reserves the right to charge for the office call. That's never been in question. Reserves the right to charge for the written prescription. Here again, it's never been in question. We're simply saying, hand them the written prescription, give them the choice. You want it filled at the front office, you want to take it someplace else. It's entirely up to them. I still see no logical argument that would contraindicate that. Just let the people have a choice.
Yeah.
Thank you for the question.
Well, the bill does specify, it prohibits the prescriber from charging a fee for the issuance of the prescription. And, you know, in terms of the, you know, the note or the statement, you know, that the owner can fill it with the prescriber if the prescriber has it or in an outside place, is your thinking that that could be, does that need to be a separate statement, or could that statement just be included on the prescription?
Chairman Dembrow, members of the committee, certainly it could be included on the prescription, and if there's the will to amend that out, I'm fine with that. I think handing the client the prescription is probably notice enough. So,
mm-hmm. Okay. And Dr. Morris, What in this bill, I mean, if we were to pass this bill, what exactly would be the impediments for providers? I mean, how would this make your job harder? I mean, you know, we've heard that if someone wants a prescription, give it to them. So what then is the downside of your just giving it to them routinely?
We tell our clients that they can get it elsewhere if they want. But to make us do this for every patient and every prescription, we see about 150 patients a day. We see multiple prescriptions in those office visits. And so we are talking, I mean, we're going to kill a tree a day. We're going to be putting out, and to write a prescription requires a several minutes of looking them up and going ahead and write and typing out that entire prescription, printing it out, and then going ahead and giving it to the client. And most of our clients, they want to have it done there and now. And so if we can verbally tell them that, which we have been doing, and it's a solution for which there is no problem. This is a situation where we already give a prescription. If the owner has all he has to do is ask, and we do it.
I mean, and just, you know, when, just to follow up, I mean, it's pretty routine for humans, you know, when we go to the doctor that we get a prescription, right?
Right, but in human medicine,
and there's not a charge for it usually.
Well, as 94% of my clinics don't charge for it either. But we are a business that is a standalone business. A doctor's office, he doesn't have any, you know, any drugs, any stock of any kind of prescriptions, because they, in human pharmacies, they don't have a wide range of the drugs that we have. And so just the other day, an owner asked for a prescription. I told her, I don't think you'll find these drugs out in the community. And she went ahead and I gave her prescription. And 4 days later, she came back and she had the prescription filled with us because nobody had that drug. And so what happened is that pet was not on medications for 4 days. And so we feel like this is just an impediment in business as well, and it's not in any way improving animal health.
Yes, Senator Robles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my concern is sometimes we do bills to do bills. They make people happier. It may affect something. I worry about this bill being one of those in the sense that I haven't seen any advocacy from any of our advocacy groups telling people on commercials or others. I see a lot of commercials for pets because I agree. Oregonians like pets. Most of us have had them all our lives and are having a really difficult time when our last dog died about whether we're going to replace that dog. So we do have that feeling. And I haven't seen any commercials or any of these advocates putting out information that says, ask your pharmacist if you want to, I mean, ask your veterinarian if you want to get a prescription for your animal. You know, my personal history with lots of pets is that I trust my veterinarian. I trust my doctor to send in a prescription, and most of the time they don't give me a prescription. They call it in, and I go pick it up. I don't know that they could do that because we haven't got – there isn't a – I agree that there's not a pharmacy out there that has everything you need to have for pets. And so they can't just call it in for us. You may not look at my history and say I don't like to make lots of bills, because I certainly put a lot of bills out there. But I am one of those people who feels that sometimes we need to be judicious in doing bills. And I don't know that I've seen an advocacy group really start pushing this idea to ask patients before we actually do a bill that requires it. I worry about the amount of time. It's not a lot, but if you're doing 75 prescriptions a day, that means maybe one less pet gets seen by a doctor that day because of the time that it takes to do that. It also means the front office, because they're the ones that usually fill out all the kind of stuff, may need another person at some point. And all of a sudden, the cost of your veterinary visit goes up. Maybe your prescriptions go down marginally. I worry about those kind of unintended consequences in a bill like this. And I don't know if you have anything to say to that, but that's my biggest concern.
Chairman Dimrow, Senator Roblin, actually, I think that's a great question. I think part of the inspiration behind this bill is exactly the cost of veterinary medicine. Bloomberg Business Week just 2 weeks ago had a very large article on the how many veterinary clinics are going corporate. That's what happened to mine. We had the same old guy for 45 years, and he sold out the VCA. And I can tell you, it's a money machine. It's about the profit. It's not about the veterinarians. I'm not sure it's about the animals, but it's about making money. I can give you a specific example. A vial of Humulin N that we give to our 11-pound poodle costs $149 at Costco. It costs $325 at our veterinarian. When we asked her, why is it so much? She said, I have no idea how much it costs. I just tell you, you need it. And I think there's that disconnect perhaps in human medicine too, that the doctor doesn't really know what the fee is. You know, we've had pets all my life, and I'm a pretty elderly guy. And my experience is, you know, that when the veterinarian says your dog needs X, go to the counter and pick it up. Well, the lady at the counter, that medicine didn't appear there magically. The veterinarian had to write down an order for someone to pull that medicine, to take it up to the front desk, to charge me for it, and to hand it to me in a white paper sack. So it isn't any different if they write it down and go grab it off the shelf. They still have to document that that medicine was prescribed. One way or the other, it had to be on a piece of paper. And so we're not asking for anything more. We're saying, when you write it down, make a copy and give it to me. I don't think there's any argument that that there's animal medication you're just not going to be able to go to Costco and find. But again, as I said in my original statement, there's no reason now for them to have it because the competition isn't there. And I believe the doctor here is right. Yeah, for flea medication or whatever, you can go to Safeway Pharmacy and get it, you know, whatever the case may be, or go for it online. But so many people don't know, and I don't see why there could possibly be opposition to the concept of informing people that this is available someplace else. That's what we're asking. Tell the people you can get it someplace else rather than creating a monopoly. So we're not saying don't get the medicine at the veterinarian. We're not saying that in any way, shape, or form. We actually, in my house, we have two veterinary ophthalmologists, so that's how deep we are into this stuff. And some of it's a compound. It's only available there. We don't argue that. And we have tens of thousands of dollars in vet bills, you know. We're happy to pay it, and we're happy for the service. But when a choice is available, we think that we know, I don't want to say we're in the industry, it's just that we've had pets all my life. A lot of people don't know. And I'm just saying, what is wrong with telling them? Don't make them ask for it. Just tell them.
Okay, thanks, Ron.
Thank you,
Vice
sir.
Vice Chair Olson and then Senator Pozanski.
Thank you. Ron, I'm going to step aside a little bit and get away from this because I realize that a lot of times when the vet, at least when I get my dogs at the vet, the prescription, they give me a form that shows me what they did for the dog, how the dog looks, the weight of the dog, and it shows the prescription on there. So I actually have a document, but it's for convenience. It's nice because they send it over to my pharmacy and I can pick it up. Hmm. But my dog has Addison's disease, and my pharmacist had to be got an explanation as the specific drugs he was on and how my dog needed them all the time, so my pharmacist carries them. The point I'd like to make, though, is when you go to the human doctor, typically, they ask you where your pharmacy is, and he types it out and shoots it over to him. By the time you get over there, it's ready for you. This is kind of the same. My vet does the same thing. But I talked to my vet about this, and the concern they had, and Doctor, I will ask you about this, is people shopping their dogs around to get prescriptive drugs that are opioids or those that are not good, like steroids, and they take their dog to two or three different vets to get those prescriptions and fill them at two or three different places. And he said several cases where people have been filling these prescriptions for bad drugs that aren't for their dog but they're using. Have you ever run into that, Doctor?
I have. And we've also run into things like that pharmacists have changed prescriptions and things that like that certain drugs in dogs are at a completely different dosage level, and the pharmacist has gone ahead and told them that that's way too much drugs, so you should only use this much, and they just don't know. And even now, with a lower level of sending to a human pharmacy, we all have documented this, and OVMA did a big survey about it, and there were all kinds of documented cases of errors and wrong things done, and not calling back to the veterinarian to ask them about it. And we do have concerns about pet health.
And follow up, Ron, have you ever just asked your vet for a prescription?
Chair Dembrough, Senator Olson, we do, you bet. But that's because I know. I mean, that's
yes,
that simple.
Yes, Ms. Rodriguez.
Thank you. I've been involved in the rescue world pretty heavily for a long time. And a lot of the reason that this bill really struck me was because it really impacts new pet parents. Pet parents who don't necessarily vet their animals on a regular basis, which is exactly what all of these market segments are trying to inspire. We're trying to inspire all people who have pets to vet them, to buy them quality food, to socialize them properly so they're good citizens, you know, run around biting everybody and digging up people's flowers. That's what we're seeing in the rescue community. And as you help individuals that have, you know, a first-time pet parent, that you get them on board with the idea of vetting on a regular basis, going, making sure you get that annual checkup, and emphasizing the importance of dentals and vaccines and so on and so forth, and licenses, that comes with a price tag. And you, Senator Roblin, you'd mentioned the advocacy groups not really promoting that idea. I think this is one of those topics that is a little off radar, just because a lot of the advocacy groups are just sort of drowning in homeless animals, saving lives, spay neuter. The big message always is spay neuter adoption. And there are these really important little things that if people knew that they could go to the vet and they wouldn't have to walk away with, you know, spending $500 on a prescription, because they could get it on petmeds.com. All they have to do is ask. They might be more inspired to say, hey, I'm going to budget this out and I'm going to make sure that I can address my animal's needs to the best of my abilities. And I think that what I would love to see is the idea of this bill because it's just information. It's information that, unless you've experienced it, like I say to people, like, ask for a prescription, because you could probably get that drug for cheaper at, you know, 1-800-PET-MEDS, or maybe not. Ask your vet. Compare the prices. I give that information, but I'm just one person. I'm just one person giving that information to someone who maybe adopts one of my fosters. And if they tell other people, that's fantastic, but they may not. And so people who are a little more tentative and a little less experienced taking their animals to the vet, this is information that they really need.
Thank you. Senator Brzezinski.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I've read the bill. I'm looking at it. And Ron, when I look at it, I just don't see it as being written the way you're explaining it. I've heard you say numerous times, just have the vet tell the person. Here it looks like it's require. I mean, it says on line 8, requires the prescriber to provide a prescription. So that's a mandate. So are you wanting something verbally done, or do you want something physically written?
Chair Dembrough, Senator Brzezinski, when I say euphemistically tell the client, it would be hand them the prescription. It would be a written prescription.
Okay. So as you've heard some of the lines of questions, to me that's a kind of different way. And I'm going to give you my life experiences. We've always used independent vets. And one of our vets did the same thing as your vet did. she realized, for whatever reason, she sold out to VCA. I noticed a remarkable difference in what the costs were immediately. And guess what? We left that place. I told the vet. She still was the operator of it, but she was under now this big umbrella. And I had a heart-to-heart talk to her because she was a very, not personal friend, but a very good friend. Yeah. And I just said, sorry, I just, you know, this isn't what I want. And because it takes the whole thing, it makes it a different picture. And so we shopped, we found someone else. And in both those practices, though, and all the practices I know, they make notes, chart notes. And on the chart notes, it says what the prescription is going to be that's being filled in-house. I've used Bi-Mart to do some filling on some stuff because it was suggested or said, you know, you can get this over there. And so I guess I'm, to me, this is mandating something that's above and beyond what I think we should be controlling. I don't see the reason, the problem to the point that you're describing. I mean, if this was a notification type thing where someone had to have a little statement that says placard that, hey, you know, you can get your medicines potentially filled somewhere else, so be it. So to me, I would be more comfortable having that discussion as compared to mandating something to be filled out.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up on another.
And then I guess, Dr. Morris, what I don't understand as to if you are filling out a prescription, just like a medical MD, why can't you put on the prescription that's going out of your building to be filled somewhere else? Do not substitute generics. Do not change or whatever it
would. We do. And yet, if they do,
and you have that documentation, what steps have you taken to call them on that and report them to the pharmacy board?
When I was the president of the OVMA, we had long talks with the pharmacy board. And even more recently, as a private practitioner, I have had the pharmacy board go to one of the pharmacies that changed the insulin type in one of our dogs and nearly killed it. So I have done that, yes, absolutely, and we've pursued it.
And what has the pharmacy board done? Do you know what type of action they took? Because those
they
are the type of things.
They only took action to reprimand. I believe there was no licensure or withdrawal or requirement for continuing education or anything. The only thing was they talked to the pharmacist in question.
Okay, Ron, and then I have a question. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Chair Dembrough. I may address this to Senator Prozanski. If Dr. Morris would agree, I would amend the bill to say every office must have a placard that states written prescriptions are available.
Yes, Dr. Morris.
I can't, or
perhaps something.
I'm a private practitioner. I can't negotiate for the organization.
And we're not going to be negotiating here now.
Yeah. No.
But yes. I mean, by far, most of our veterinary practices are one and two man practices in this state still. There are large corporations, but most of us are smaller practitioners. Just we're getting by, little businessmen, just like everybody else.
How about business persons?
That doesn't bother me.
Since my vets are all women.
I just don't understand how this can make a better pet parent by me having to write a prescription for that animal. It sounds like the discussion is this is the only way veterinarians ever make money, and we're a personal service business. We examine pets, we diagnose, we do a lot of background information, and at the very end of that, we do sell prescriptions because it's expedites pet health, and they can start on those medications in 1 hour, you know.
Okay, great. Well,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would just make a statement to Ms. Rodriguez that I have a bill that allows tax deduction for adoption of pets, and I'd like to.
Mr. Chair, I don't think that's germane.
Germany? We're in Germany now? I just wanted to throw that. 326.
Yes, that bill is being considered by this committee.
Is there a state dog possibly being considered?
Okay, well, thank you, all three of you.
Thank you for
bringing this bill. I'll be talking to the different members to see if there's perhaps some tweaks to this that we could put in or not. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. With that, I will close this public hearing on Senate Bill 222, and we will move to Senate Bill 359.
Poor Lou, we got away.
Senator Frederick, Beth, could you tell us what the bill is about? And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 359 would establish a $1,000 personal or corporate income tax credit for a taxpayer who creates jobs during a removal or remedial action under the state's hazardous waste and hazardous materials cleanup statutes. There is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
Okay. Senator Frederick, thank you for your patience.
Oh, sure.
I know you're a pet owner, so it's an issue I know you care about.
I do have a little animal that somehow owns the house.
I have seen that.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough and members of the committee. I'm Senator Lou Frederick, Senate District 22, North and Northeast Portland. Senate Bill 359 represents one approach to dealing with a significant problem in all of our districts. The last time I asked for an estimate, there were almost 300 small contaminated sites in my district. And an interesting thing I discovered in looking into it is that all districts have comparable numbers. Now they're closer together in my district because everything is closer together in my district. But rural districts have them too. There are old gas stations or fuel depots with leaking underground storage tanks. There are old machine shops where solvent and fuel disposal took place under mid-20th century practices. There are former dry cleaners, something the statute gives a great deal of special attention to. Photo finishing shops, battery dealers and recyclers, and farm chemical storage. Some of the chemicals stored could not even be used now, much less stored in a way that leaves residues in the ground. In fact, most cases, the businesses and owners who did the contamination are long gone. The land is unusable because of toxic substances. Structures on the land fall into disrepair and become eyesores and hazards in their own right. These are usually commercial properties zoned for commercial use with commercial access and utilities available. However, our property tax system provides some perverse incentives to just let these properties sit. Also, owners wait, hoping for the best economic conditions to make development pencil out after the expense of remediation. Or families that have inherited these properties wait, hoping for a better deal on the sale. So this is a well of available property, currently not contributing to the economy, and in fact a drag on the value of the surrounding property, as well as the quality of the neighborhood experience. I'm not the only one working on this, because it by no means is just a Portland problem, and there are several bills that take different approaches to making it more likely that these properties will be appropriately cleaned up and returned to productive use. So the approach I'm proposing is a tax credit, with the intention that a cost to the Treasury would be offset by taxes on wages generated by jobs created during removal or remedial actions. It's a narrowly focused approach. Others are bringing much grander ideas. It provides a $1,000 against taxes otherwise due if 25 or more jobs are created or the number of jobs is increased by 30% over a 3-year period during removal or remedial action. That's it. That's all I'm asking. The idea is to have an incentive to have people clean up and then create businesses on these old brownfields. That's all.
Great. Thank you, Senator. Yes, Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Frederick, appropriate bill. Just a couple of questions for you. Number one, you say in the bill that the credit is allowed if Department of Environment Quality has certified the taxpayer's eligibility to claim the credit. I think you need to add to make this bill a little stronger, a little thing that says that they must be also licensed by Construction Contractors Board.
Ah.
Because you have to have the DEQ certificate, but to get that, you have to be licensed by the Construction Contractors Board. Otherwise, you'd have people out there saying, hey, I need to get this credit because I'm going to put on some people to tear a building down. The other question, if I may, Mr.
Yes.
Chair, the other statement I would make is that in my personal opinion, as a contractor, I think you might be a little bit high when it creates 25 or more jobs, because if you're tearing down a dry cleaning establishment, you'd probably have three or four people on there, a couple of laborers, an operator. They'd be tearing the building down and dumping it in the dump truck. So I don't think you'd ever reach the 25-person threshold. So I think you might want to just take a look at that and see if, you know, you might be able to tweak that. And then the other one where you increase the number of jobs by 30% over a three-year period, probably only take a month to tear the building down at tops. So I just as suggestions to make this maybe a little cleaner bill from a contractor standpoint, you might want to make those just a hair smaller so that somebody could actually take advantage of your credit. I think it's a good idea.
I appreciate that. In fact, I'll try to make sure that we do that. We did pass a bill in 2011 that began the process to allow greater chances for people to do some remediation on brownfields. But I thank you. The 25 jobs was something that we looked at and we thought we should work at. But in many cases, the land that you're talking about is not a large piece of property. It's often just a corner. It's the corner gas station.
Right.
That is no longer being used. Thank you.
Yeah, follow up. And I think, Senator, that if you would contact CCB, you would find that some of these people that are licensed to do this are very small in scope, you know, maybe 5-10 employees tops. And I think it would be it would give you a good criteria of what should you look like, how many employees should they add on to fix a job.
Sounds good.
Because I don't think there's a lot of guys out there that, you know, have 25 employees to do this kind of work.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to follow up on that, too, because I think, you know, I helped with a remediation issue on two pieces of property, one in Eugene and one in Lincoln City, that took the previous senator 4 years of hers and 3 years of my time to finally get the DQ, everybody to agree that the remediation had happened. So they might have said it took 25 people, but it didn't take that many people for very long. So, you know, even if it's a gas station, and the one in Eugene, they dug out all the ground as deep as they could go, but they couldn't dig out underneath the road, which they said may still have had stuff. And then they replaced it with all good stuff. That still didn't take that many people very long to do it, and it was done in a period of time. So what's 25 jobs? Is it 25 jobs for a day, or is it 25 jobs, you know, figuring out what those really mean? You know, or how many hours it takes to do it. There might be a better way to do it by hours. I don't know, but I want it to be used, and I tend to agree that the way it's written right now, very few of these big contractors or even any of the small contractors could actually qualify for the $1,000. And if we're going to do an incentive, I want an incentive that really works, because we do every district in the state of Oregon has these places in them. I agree with you 100% on that.
The DEQ, thank you, Senator. The DEQ was real clear when they put the map out, and it was really interesting for the districts. Everyone knew exactly where those spaces were, those empty lots, and they weren't sure on that. I will try to make sure that we do some more research and get some amendments regarding that. But thank you.
Great. Okay. Any other questions? No. Seeing none. Yeah. So the process here is, you know, ideally any amendments to the substance of the bill we should do in this committee,
right.
And then if we decide to send it on to tax credits, they're just looking at the financial implications of it.
As I expected. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Senator. Okay, so with that, I'm going to close this public hearing on Senate Bill 359, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 373. Beth, and Senator Hansel, you want to come up? Yeah. We'll just have him present the bill. And if you could summarize it, please, Beth.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 373 would direct the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to develop and adopt by rule a pilot program for urban deer population control.
All right. We're continuing on a theme, sort of.
Oh,
Senator Hansel, you are going to be Mr. Salvage, or creator of salvage.
Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hansel, state senator from District 29. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you regarding Senate Bill 373, or what might be called the Urban Deer Population Bill. I thought it might be helpful to give you some background on how this bill came to be. In April of 2016, we were contacted by the mayor of Joseph, Oregon, Mr. Dennis Sands, regarding the deer within their city. Mayor Sands stated there were 150 deer in the 0.8 by 0.8 square mile city limit. He stated he contacted Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife about the issue. They said, yes, Joseph does seem to have a lot of deer. However, we will be unable to relocate them. This is due to the fact that past deer relocations, they have returned to the same places they were taken from. Mayor Sands asked for my help. I held a meeting with Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director, and Ron Anglin, a former wildlife manager, regarding the issue in Joseph. They stated, actually, Joseph was not alone. There are many cities that have deer population problems, such as John Day, Union, Ashland, parts of Portland, to name a few. My office began working to craft a bill that would give local control to cities and the opportunity to deal with the situation, if they chose. LOC, we met with them, and they are supportive of this bill. We met with the Oregon Food Bank to see if there was a way for them to be involved, and there was. By working with the Oregon Food Bank, we discovered they could and desired to use the meat in their local pantries. Senate Bill 373 creates a pilot program for cities, if they decide to do so, to humanely euthanize and remove the problem deer within the city. This is an attempt to bring the population levels to a more manageable number. Once the animals have been removed, the meat will be donated to the local food banks. It should be emphasized this is local control at the city's cost. If the city decides they do not want to pursue this option, they don't have to. The cost of the removal of deer rests with the city. What does this bill not do? This bill does not allow hunters to march through neighborhoods shooting deer. It does not allow for cities.
Sure.
That's what they all say.
They can just drive over, right?
Exactly.
It does not allow for cities to remove deer at any time. ODF&W must agree to it. It does not require a city to participate. It is not a mandate. We left the specific program up to the department to create through rulemaking. However, we did list a few specifics. First, the deer would be removed without the use of dart or lethal injection. This is because the food bank said they could not accept the meat if darts were used. Secondly, it is the intent of the bill to have an agency such as State Animal Damage Control do the humane euthanasia. Thirdly, cities could be able to keep the hides and antlers if they wanted to from the deer to offset city costs. And fourthly, ODF&W must confirm that the city is experiencing nuisance deer, and ODF&W would control the number of deer taken to reduce the population to a level that is no longer constitutes a public nuisance. A city cannot remove every deer from the city. And finally, before this program can even be implemented, if a city qualifies, they must implement wildlife feeding ordinances. This bill has a sunset to see if this type of program is successful. The sunset is in 2027, allowing 7 years for the program to be operational, giving 17 and 18 for the department to create the rules of the program. Again, the bill attempts to solve the need in many cities from across the state. It forbids the feeding of wildlife and removes the problem deer to bring the population numbers to a more sustainable number. Joseph already has deer dying in people's front yards because there's not enough food for all 150. I'm sure other cities have similar situations. Thank you for the opportunity, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. I have a question, Senator. In your conception of this, I mean, usually when I think of a pilot program, I think of something that's, you know, one or two cities try it out. But it sounds like this could be open to all cities. Is that, I just want to know what your intent is. Yeah.
That would be, yes.
It would be
pilot
open.
May not be the best way to describe it, but if a city wants to participate, we want to give them the opportunity.
during, and so the pilot nature of it would be, you know, that it's this would be something that would last 10 years or
yes,
you know, whatever, and then it needs to be reconsidered.
Yes, that's
okay. Senator Prezant.
Yeah, I guess I just want clarification. I see it's got a subsequent to Ways and Means. Is that because State Fish and Wildlife Commission has a duty to come up with the program, and that's where the cost is?
Exactly. We asked the same question, Senator, and that was what we were told. There's
right. Yeah, I should put on the record that we received a note from the Senate President's office that LFO doesn't think they actually need it referred to them. So we could remove that subsequent referral.
Thank you.
So I'm not sure that the agency wants to hear that, but that's that's what we were notified, that presumably they could do it within their existing resources or on the cheap.
On the cheap. Or for the venison.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, yes, yeah, Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if the deer are dying, probably obviously malnutrition, you said, they wouldn't have a lot of meat for the food bank. And would the processing be worse than the other removal?
Well, right now, I don't think they're planning to Senator Denbrough, Senator Roblin, you're right. When they die, they're pretty emaciated, and there isn't a whole lot there. This would be more for healthy animals.
Yes. Senator Bertrager.
Do we have are the food bank going to testify?
Yes, they will.
Okay, I'll wait okay. For them.
You're awfully kind.
Okay, thanks, Senator.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for bringing this to us. Okay, so let's hear from the agency next. Russ Stout and Doug Compton, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Denbrough, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Russ Stoff. I'm actually the Rogue Watershed Manager from Central Point. I'm filling in this week for Shannon Hearn. With me today is Doug Cottom, our Wildlife Division Administrator from headquarters here. And we'd like to present testimony. We're neutral on the bill, of course, but we'd like to present testimony and take questions here today. Thank you.
The applause had nothing to do with the statement of your neutrality.
Try to time that.
Yeah.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Cottom. I'm the Wildlife Division Administrator for the department, and I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 373. That, as Senator Hansel just mentioned, it does create a pilot program that enables cities to petition the department for the authorization to control overabundant deer within city limits. You know, some of our communities do have resident deer, and oftentimes it does lead to undesirable conflicts. The presence of deer can actually be a human safety issue at times, with collisions with automobiles, and occasionally there are direct aggressive interactions between deer and people. And there are some other consequences. People often begin to feed wildlife or provide attractants to them for their own yard. And there's certainly a difference of opinion amongst people about the value of urban deer, and also differences in opinions about the solutions for finding to deer-human conflicts. As the lead agency for dealing with wildlife conflicts, we do work actively and currently with cities and communities to try to address these deer conflicts. As written, this bill would codify the existing processes that we go through for addressing these kind of conflicts. So the department does have concerns that this would establish some inflexible approach to developing solutions, and may cause some undue complications for the cities that are involved. We do believe that our workload would increase as a result of this. We would have to review petitions. We would have to assess the urban deer populations. We would have to have some sort of oversight on the carcass handling and the donations to charities. And we would also have to collect and disperse the hides and antlers of the deer that were taken in the city. We do appreciate that Senate Bill 373 requires cities to pass ordinances that would restrict the feeding of wildlife and disallow the attractants that people may put out, especially for deer. And ordinances like that, they really can be some of the best deterrents to resolving some of these conflicts by helping prevent wildlife from becoming habituated to people and to these communities and ultimately becoming permanent residents. And that was it, briefly, for my testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. I have a question first.
Go first.
Could you say something about how would you envision the rulemaking happening for this? I mean, if the goal were to have the rulemaking be, you know, inclusive, but also, you know, done in a way that would, you know, retain as much flexibility as possible. You know, I appreciate your concern that this could limit flexibility, but is there a way that the rules could be developed so that you'd still have a high degree of flexibility with how to deal with the problem and have it be case by case depending on the city?
Chair Denbro, that's actually a very difficult question to answer. Currently, inside city limits, people can't discharge firearms. And if we were to lose the ability to use tranquilizer dart guns and to euthanize deer, that would be really the only feasible option for removing deer from a city. So the choices that are left are either to do nothing about them in terms of removing them or to kill them and provide them to charity. So we would be limited to, and what we currently do are we provide mostly a lot of advice to communities about how to deal with urban deer. For instance, recommendations on things like fencing and what to plant and what not to plant, and trying to discourage folks from attracting wildlife in a manner that they would become habituated. But our options are limited inside city limits as it is.
Clarification, how are you going to kill them?
That's my question.
If you're not taking them down with a dart to tranquilize them or knock them down, and then I'm not sure how you're going to
trap them. That was my question. How are you going to kill them?
Yeah.
Oh,
thing. You have to shoot them. If you can't tranquilize them.
Chair Denbro, Senator Brzezinski, when it comes to city, within the city limits.
Right. An individual cannot fire.
The way I understand the concept of the bill is that the city would have agents who remove the deer themselves, either by shooting them or trapping them and shooting them. So that way that there wouldn't be any drugs involved, so that the meat would be edible.
Senator Olson.
Well, that was my question, but if they actually, I mean, trapping, you're the expert, trapping would be extremely difficult. And you can't, if you just pull out a rifle and plug him in the city, the chance that that bullet could travel elsewhere and do other damage is
pretty
astronomical.
High.
I don't think I'd be doing my 30 officers inside the city.
No,
so the question is, how do we make this a functional piece of legislation that works, that gets rid of the deer, but doesn't hurt anybody else, and maybe would provide food to the food bank? We could have Senator Hansel dress up like a grizzly bear or something and drive him out. But how do you envision this being able to be done? If there's a deer problem in Eugene, how would you do that?
Senator Olson, it's like I said, this is a very difficult situation to try to sort out how these animals can be safely and lethally removed. It is very true that trying to trap deer is usually unsuccessful, and there is an incredible amount of effort that the agents of the cities would have to go through to try to catch them. One of the biggest problems, if not the largest problem that you have inside urban areas, is all of the private property, and the fact that one person's property may be a refuge for the animals. And that's the way the folks like it.
Are you saying a sanctuary property?
That's how you deal with an agent. They have bedding for them.
Rusty.
Chair Denbro, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, I wanted to just add one point to Chair Dembrough's question on rulemaking and the difficulty. The issue of dealing with identifying, defining nuisance and administering that, we certainly appreciate Senator Hansel's interest in trying to resolve this problem. It is a problem around the state, and it is a difficult one, so we certainly appreciate that very much. The issue of nuisance in rule development could be a difficult issue for us as well.
But, you know, going back to the you know, how do you terminate the animal? What if the, you know, what if the donation to the food bank element, don't look at me, people back there, but what if that were removed from it? I mean, I think we all agree that's one of the really attractive features of this proposal, but if the only way that you could really realistically capture these animals is through a tranquilizer dart, and then, you know, and then destroy them. Would that be doable?
Chair Dembrough, typically when you use tranquilizer darts in urban areas, you have the issue of that the animals don't immediately go to sleep.
Right.
So they run off, and oftentimes they will cross property boundaries. And then once again, we have to deal with the opinions and preferences of the new landowner where the deer might fall asleep. And so that oftentimes when it comes to trying to capture deer inside city limits with a tranquilizer dart gun, you're very limited as to the number of animals that you're going to catch anyway.
Okay. Yeah, Senator Roblin.
So two things. One, just a statement. We have our urban deer in Coos Bay, and when I built a garden for my wife, building a deer fence in urban areas is really weird, because my family that lives out on the farm, they have deer fences, and it makes sense. It's kind of weird in city, but if you want to keep anything, you build a fence. So we do have these urban deer. They are an issue. And the one thing that I found is a real positive about this one, in your expedition of looking at that deal, Joseph would qualify for an urban setting for to use the project, for us to use as a pilot. They could become a pilot project, correct? And my friends have always said there's this urban-rural divide, and if Joseph is part of the urban part of the state, then I think there is less of an urban-rural divide than I thought before.
Absolutely.
Progress again.
Yeah. A city's a city,
this
right?
is going to be the theme of the 2017 session.
Yeah. Yes.
How we are healing that divide.
Okay.
In all sorts of creative ways.
I appreciate senator from Mr. Hansel for trying to do that. So.
Senator Bertschiger, help us.
A couple things. I'm surprised Joseph doesn't have a few cowboys around there to take care of that, but or we could stake out a couple wolves. No, really, my concern on this bill, realistically, during the month of December, can we really distinguish between urban deer and Santa's reindeer? I mean, that could be really...
Good point.
That would be tough.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
What would be the feasibility of deer repellent spread around town?
Senator Olson, there are some deer repellents that do work, and we would often recommend that. One of the, you know, drawbacks sometimes to some of the successful deer repellents is that you might not be able to apply them to your vegetables and then eat them. So it doesn't work for everybody. But it's a possibility, and we certainly do recommend it.
Yeah. But don't aerial spray.
No.
Right. And they do recommend, there are some plants that the deer will avoid, and you guys have done a good job of allowing people like my wife to find out what those are. So we can plant some of those, which is interesting.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay, let's hear from the food bank, please. Okay. Philip, I want you to get us out of this conundrum.
It's getting late in the afternoon.
That's your job.
Yeah, that's true.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee for record, Philip Kennedy Wong, Oregon Food Bank. I'll try to keep my comments brief. We're here to support the intent of Senate Bill 373, and just wanted to share, you know, we're ready to work with all the parties involved to make this a possibility. We also know there is a lot of questions and, you know, logistics and resources needed, and that's really for us, from our perspective, I think the greater challenge in terms of how do we take the situation that has become a problem for, you know, probably not just Joseph, Oregon, but other communities, and turn it into something that can help families that are experiencing hunger. And I do have the sad news of sharing with you that Oregon has spiked in its hunger rate, the highest in the nation over the last 3 years. We're now at 16.1%. That's our hunger rate as compared to the national average of 13.7, I believe. So we're not moving forward, unfortunately, and this is after 50 consecutive months of job growth. So that brings us back to why we're here, why we were very happy and appreciative toward to Senator DeHansel for starting this conversation and inviting us to be part of the solution, as he has obviously a real constituent issue that he's trying to resolve. I thought I'd share with you two examples of what we've done with game meat. I think one, I would say, was a great experience, and the other was, I would say, a hard lesson. So currently, right now, we do have one food bank in Clatsop County that is taking game meat, and it wasn't an overnight process, but essentially our food bank director there was able to develop good relationships with the local ODF&W personnel and also state police. And the vast majority of the game that they received were confiscated kills that the state police had brought and sort of verified that the carcass was still in a condition that was fit for human consumption. It would typically be a process where the state police would actually bring the animal already dressed, and the food bank, all it needed to do was actually process it and grind it. So that food bank in Clatsop County went to the lengths of raising resources to get a commercial-grade meat grinder and also take out a food processing license, you know, to ensure that all the proper food safety precautions were taken. But we also know just from that experience that, you know, there's also a lot of things that we have to take into consideration, like, you know, the documentation, like where the animal is from, how long it's been dead. So that food bank has taken, I would say, the extra mile in, you know, recording all of that information, because we want to make sure, like, which state trooper brought the animal, when it was, you know, brought, and what in their estimation was the time of death for that animal, so on and so forth, to also labeling the product when we do distribute it out to the pantries that receive food from, you know, that food bank. We have had conversations of trying to replicate that on a statewide basis, but it's been like on a case-by-case basis, because not every part of the state is either blessed or cursed with, you know, nuisance deer. So that's one, what I would characterize as a positive experience. I think the other experience I wanted to share with you has to do with something that actually happened before my time with the food bank, but in Central Oregon, years ago, we were contacted with, I believe there were geese that were a nuisance in this park, and I think, to my understanding, it was like, you know, hundreds of geese, and I don't know which local government that was responsible, whether it was a county or the city, but they had come to the food bank saying, you know, we have this nuisance of geese. They're, you know, they are destroying, you know, the habitat, so on and so forth. They are fit for human consumption, you know. Would you like to have them? And, you know, being very inexperienced in that at that time, given game donations, we said, sure, you know, because we want to increase the supply of, you know, protein-rich food, because that's a type of food that's not getting donated enough, and it's also the type of food that costs us money when we do have to buy it, and we often have to buy protein. But what we learned in that experience was the logistics and the challenge, and even the disposal of the carcasses that's unused was a big logistical challenge. And I think for some of us that experienced that, not me personally, but you know, they would obviously have reservations about doing that again, because sometimes in a very, very weird way, the way our economic systems work, it's probably at points cheaper to actually buy, you know, protein than it is to go through some of the logistics that would be involved to facilitate a donation. I share that both the positive and I would say negative experience as sort of like, you know, we come into this conversation with all the parties eyes wide open. We want to be there to help problem solve, and we know that this bill is probably a starting point and not an end point for, you know, fully maximizing the game system and game management that we have here as a source of food for food banks.
Thank you, Phil. Yes, Senator Bertrager.
thank you, Mr. Chair. So here in the States, USDA, they're responsible for all the kill floors and have a licensed veterinarian on scene to inspect these animals, whether it's beef or whatever. And the kill floors are pretty they have to meet certain criteria. My question to the food bank is, can you folks put meat into the public that have not been inspected by a veterinarian? And if you do, do you assume all the liabilities that go with that if somebody gets sick?
Chair Demereaux and Senator Bertrager, that's a great question. So the way that we work, well, the way that we understand the federal regulations with game meat is that game meat is not required to go through a USDA inspected process, which is interesting, but that's another day for a different debate. So based on that, the way that we would like to work with game donations is essentially the donor, either the hunter or whoever the person presenting the animal, we would actually prefer they take it to a custom exempt butcher that's regulated and licensed by the Oregon Department of Ag, and then bring us the byproduct. We want to take ourselves out of that equation. We're not like an expert on veterinary health and what's edible and what's not edible in that respect, but we want to make sure that those that are knowledgeable are part of that process. So that's what we've done in the past, is we try to encourage folks to go through, take that animal to a custom exempt shop that's inspected by Oregon Department of Ag.
Follow up.
Yeah.
So I understand that very clear, but are you familiar that a USDA kill floor and a game processing facility, they cannot merge? In other words, they cannot be in the same room, and it's even hard to have them in the same building. You have to have a solid wall between the two of them, because you cannot have cross-contaminated between meat that goes to the public and meat that just goes to the private sector.
Chair Demereaux and Senator Bertrager, yes, we understand it fully. I think my understanding of the way meat processing works is that you have the USDA inspected facilities, and they, for the most part, focus just on their business that's on what's called domesticated species, if I think that's the proper termination. So we're talking poultry, cattle, so on and so forth, all the animals that are regulated by the USDA. With custom exempt, those typically don't tend to be USDA inspected. Those tend to only handle a couple of types of meat products. One could be a game animal. The other could be a rancher that has, say, an animal, like a cow, and owns it and then wants to sell it to a party no more than four parties. They can take that to a custom exempt and have it split into four different ways. And that custom exempt business still is not USDA inspected, because it's a smaller batch, just from my understanding of how the difference that works between custom exempt shops and then USDA inspected. So I'm sure there are USDA inspected businesses that do game business, but I'm not aware of any that's come across in my time with the food bank. What we found is typically they're either one or the other. I mean, our biggest challenge with USDA inspected facilities is a lot of them are what's called captured facilities. They have contracts that keep them busy, for the lion part of a whole year. So when we do get cattle donations, our problem is trying to fit it into their schedule at a time that's convenient and economical for them. And a lot of times it forces us to turn away cattle donations when that's when that comes up. We would like to in the future. I know we're getting off topic, but when we do get ones and twosies sort of steers of cattle donated, we'd like to be able to take it to a custom exempt and break it down. But currently, the way the USDA law is interpreting what you can do with that small donation, they are not permitting it.
Yes.
Well, I would caution you to check with your legal minds, because I, as a rancher, cannot sell the beef on the hook to the public. I can sell the beef on the hoof before it is slaughtered, and it can go to a custom shop. Then the new owners take possession. But I cannot send a beef and sell it off the hook in a custom shop.
Chair Dembrough, Senator Bershwer, I think I'm in agreement with you. I think that's the way we understand it as well.
So that's why I'm a little nervous on on the wild game. I would make sure I check with your legal minds on that.
That's why I'm looking at you.
Senator Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with the bill we had that Debbie Boone had a few years ago with regard to bycatch, we did that through regular processors, right? So we didn't take any of the fish. We took it only if it was processed before it came to you.
Chair Dembrough and Senator Roblin, so the way the bycatch worked, it had more to do with the fish cleaning businesses feeling or needing to feel legally secure in possessing bycatch because they were concerned about, jeopardizing their commercial license by taking on bycatch if they felt that if the bycatch was considered illegal, whether under federal law or other, territorial agreements on, fish. So what that bill did was to clarify that a fish cleaning business could take possession of that and clean it on behalf of a charitable organization.
Right, well, thank you, Phil. I have one last question. That is, are you aware of any other food banks around the country that have a program like the one that's being proposed here? They've figured out a way to overcome the challenges?
Chair Dembrough, yes, there are several states that do have game donation programs, and they're all slightly different. Like, for example, in the state of Texas, they have a program that really takes place at the custom exempt level. So, for example, they have custom exempt butchers that sign up to participate in a donation program where when a hunter brings in his kill, he can check off, when he's asking the butcher to make X number of sausages, make X number of cuts, that they can leave a portion of it.
But let me jump in and say, but specifically something like this urban deer problem,
wow.
The issue of how we capture and how we kill them.
I'm not aware. I do know that there is a state that permits, to be crass, roadkill under certain conditions, and I want to say it's Missouri. It's in the Midwest. It's been a couple of years since I've looked into this, but that's the closest I can think of, but it's been a while. There might be some states that have since then put in programs that might be comparable.
Here in this committee, we call it salvage.
Right? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, if it's Missouri, yes. It's probably possum.
Okay, great. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wanted to testify on this bill? And Scott, this is not, we're not talking about PERS here, That's next door.
We're just a friendlier crowd.
Yeah, we're not friendlier.
Yes. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, I was there earlier, so I'll talk about PERS and now deer harvesting, nuisance deer. So we are supportive of the bill.
Who are you, sir?
I'm sorry, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. League of Oregon Cities is an association that's comprised of all 241 incorporated cities in the state of Oregon. We are supportive of this bill. We have a number of I think there are a number of cities in eastern central Oregon, possibly on the coast, where they would like to have some options on how do they deal with an overpopulation issue. It's where it becomes a public safety issue, deer on the roadway at night, those sorts of things. I will relay briefly a story. The mayor of John Day has regularly advises people on motorcycles to not do so at night, largely due to the likelihood or the propensity to possibility of hitting a deer on the road. So it is becoming an issue. I will point out that I live in a city of 50,000, and we have the tigered, and it's not uncommon for us to find them in our city. Not to suggest that tigered really views this as appropriate, but it is a statewide issue.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Senator Roblin.
So you have all the cities, right?
Chair Dembrough, Senator Roblin, yes.
And they're all considered urban areas for this bill?
Under the definition of Senator Dembrough, Chair Dembrough, Senator Roblin, that is my reading of the bill.
makes me happy.
Okay.
We have a conversation about urban-rural divide, and it's clearly
getting closer.
Closer.
It's, we're narrowing.
Right.
Making safe haven from the wolves.
Okay, thanks a lot,
sir.
Scott. Okay, so Senator Hensel, I'll look forward to working with you on this and see what we can do with it. Great. Okay, so with that, colleagues, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 373, we are adjourned.
Monday.
We are adjourned.